The 65th chapter of Isaiah are pointed to a time in the future. Isaiah, the prophet's looking forward. And with the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, the world reached a turning point and history made a new beginning. And so we call the time before Jesus BC, meaning before Christ. And the years from then on, Anno Domini, AD, the year of the Lord, or the Christian era. Nowadays, to avoid causing offence to adherents of other faiths, we sometimes replace these terms with CE, meaning Common Era, or BCE, before the Common Era. East Asia and South Asia have a more circular view of history than do the great monotheistic religions, and yet even those religions, which have their own way of naming the date, recognise that for historical purposes, Western civilizations divided between the years before and after the birth of Jesus. And most of them are also quite happy to celebrate Christmas with us, as we celebrate the festivals with them if we have the chance, because the historical events they commemorate are also important. Christians see the birth of Jesus as the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. I'm about to create the new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind. Now, from the Jewish perspective, a Jewish writer once produced a joke in the form of a verse. He wrote, "Roses are red and violets are blush, bluish. Roses are red and violets are bluish. If it wasn't for Christmas, we should all be Jewish." Now, the humour may be a little ironic, but there's a truth behind it, because Jesus was a Jew after all. He never claimed that his teaching was anything other than a reinterpretation of the Jewish scriptures, and yet he spoke with authority. He often gave a radically new twist to what his fellow Jews believed in. But the Jewish morality was widely recognised as the best that there was in the ancient world, and many non-Jews were attracted to it before Jesus came. And yet the way that people behave has changed for the better since the coming of Jesus. You only have to read the history of the Roman Empire with its acceptance of widespread violence and debauchery to see that the majority of people in the parts of the world that have been influenced by the teaching of Jesus Christ live more moral lives than would have been conceivable then, although certainly our morals these days are slipping fast. There is still wide immorality, even in high places. Cynics may allege that the overall behaviour hasn't changed much and that people still do the wicked things they used to do. And even if that were so, and it probably isn't, then the standards by which their conduct is judged by their neighbours and by their consciences have to be changed out of all recognition. And that's entirely due to the coming of Jesus. Many people, more than perhaps we will ever know, make their target in life the love that Jesus described and that he demonstrated in his own life and his own death. Before Christ, BC, the commands to love God and to love our neighbour were known, but Jesus made these commands the centre of his message. Love God. Love your neighbour as yourself. You see, what has changed is that Christians now seek to model their lives on that of Jesus Christ, not simply responding to the ways that others treat them, but proactively seeking opportunities to love other people in gratitude for the way that Jesus loves us. And our attitude towards God has changed too. We no longer cringe with fear before an awesome judge because of Christmas. We know that God has so loved this world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. Christmas is the visual evidence and the confirmation that God is 100% love. Since the calendar changed from BC to AD, there has been a radical change in the world centered on the birth of Jesus Christ. Long before the hippies of the 1960s introduced the idea of New Age religion, Christians were proclaiming that we're already in the New Age, the age of love. And the coming of God incarnate made such a difference that we can truly say that God has created a whole new world, a new heaven and a new earth. And let's thank him for that in his church, and then go out and enjoy the new context which God has made for us to live our lives in, this new world of love. Let's gladly receive love from God and from other human beings whenever it's offered to us. And let's love God and serve our neighbours gladly with love because of Christmas. And that way we can make Christmas last all year round. We'll sing again and then we'll read from Matthew's Gospel. Let's Omega and Alpha, He, the beginning and the end, the beginning of all history, the end of history. He is indeed the crux of history. Jesus fills history. As we think of the time before his birth and the time after, how things are so different. We know that with every new birth there are birth pangs. And Matthew in his Gospel certainly tells us of one of the awful birth pangs, the pains of the birth of the new age. We read from Matthew chapter 2 and from verse 16 there of chapter 2 of Matthew's Gospel. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time Herod had learned from the Magi. I think one of the most heartbreaking acts of vandalism that we've seen here in Dunfermline over the past year has surely been the damage done to the children's memorial in the Gardens of Remembrance. Sadly, most people, I think, can think of a child who has died. We think of the heartbreak of the parents, the grief of the family who were making plans for the child's future, which will never come about. We think of the perplexity of friends who wonder why bad people grow old, whereas innocent children seem cut off when their life has hardly begun. I'll never forget the first time I conducted a funeral for a baby, or the first funeral I led for a child who'd been killed in a road accident. We're all scarred by the death of innocent children. We read the statistics of the number of children killed in natural disasters or in wars. We think of those children who have been killed in Gaza after the Israeli bombings over the past day or two. And it's hard to translate that into individual bereavements and into tragedies. Some children have nobody to grieve for them. I read a story about the Vietnam War, during which many poor mothers bore children who'd been fathered by Vietnamese or American soldiers, now swept away by the fortunes of war. And the mothers couldn't afford to keep the children, and so they left these children on the doorsteps of a Roman Catholic convent. And the Vietnamese nuns who lived in that convent did their best, but that often consisted of lining up 100 cots and stuffing babies into the baby's mouths, and if the bottle fell out or if it leaked scalding milk over the child's naked body, then nobody had the time to help them. There was one charity which tried to keep the babies alive until they could be adopted. They did so by asking British civilian families in Saigon to foster an orphan until it was ready to fly overseas. And these babies had never learned to cry in the orphanage because it did them no good. Well, imagine the joy of the couple I read when the orphan they had fostered, who'd been given the name of Lindsay, uttered her first cry. They were overjoyed because here was a baby beginning to interact with the world around her. And then imagine their grief the next evening when that baby suffered a cot death. They felt a responsibility to keep her memory alive in their hearts, otherwise she'd be totally forgotten. And so they told the story of these Vietnamese babies. I wonder if that kind of pathetic story helps you to enter into the grief of the mothers of Bethlehem when King Herod massacred their children, or perhaps the mothers in Gaza as they mourn their own loved ones today. To Herod, these deaths were no more than statistics, but to their mothers, these were much loved babies, wee boys, individual children whose lives of hope and promise had been amputated when they'd only just started to grow. The least that you and I can do is to keep the memory of those children alive in our hearts at least once a year as we recount the Christmas story, and to remember them with all the other children down the ages who have nobody now to mourn their deaths. King Herod, as I said to the children earlier, who ordered their deaths, is remembered today mainly for that single massacre. But he was in many ways a good king. He was a complex personality. Herod was not a Jew, he was an Arab. But his father had married a member of the Jewish royal family. King Herod the Great, as he was known, formed lasting friendships with the Roman emperors and yet defended the independence of the Jewish nation. And he defended their laws against all those who wanted to occupy their land. Herod the Great built many palaces and fortresses, some of which are still imposing ruins to this day. And above all, he rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem, restoring the central sanctuary to the dimensions which it had had in Solomon's day. He built it in shining white marble. He extended the courtyard around it by building vaulted chambers, raising it high above the surrounding valleys. And standing on its hilltop site, it must have been one of the most imposing temples in the whole of the Roman Empire. That was Herod's good side, but Herod was also terrified that he'd be assassinated by someone who wanted to seize his throne. And not without reason, for there were several hopefuls who tried. And to protect himself, Herod killed all his rivals, including his beloved wife Miriam, his mother-in-law, his brother, three of his sons, 45 members of the Jewish council. The Emperor Augustus, knowing that Jewish people won't eat pork, joked that he'd rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son. And already driven mad by the pain of arteriosclerosis, which eventually killed him, it's hardly surprising that Herod ordered the massacre of the children in Bethlehem when the wise men told him that the Messiah, who was to become the king of the Jews, had been born there. In spite of all the good he did, King Herod the Great is remembered forever because of his cruelty. The children whom he killed are also remembered, but for the opposite reason, because they were slaughtered in their innocence. This is the uncomfortable part of the Christmas story. It's the birth pang of the new earth. It's not the nice parts that we include in our nativity plays and our Christmas carols, but it comes as a challenge to us every year. And I want to finish with this thought. When you're dead, will you be remembered for the good you did, or for your wrongdoing? Or will you be forgotten because you never did much of either? May God bless his word to us every time we read from it.